Was wir sonst noch lesen, behandelt heute Bücher von Terry Goodkind, Neil Gaiman, Michael Connelly, John Scalzi und Josh Bezell. Der Nachfolger des hier vor einigen Monaten ausführlich besprochenen American Gods vom Briten Neil Gaiman heißt Anansi Boys, wobei es insofern eher ein Spin-off ist, als dass wir diesmal nicht auf den Straßen der US of A unterwegs sind, als uns vielmehr in einem London wie aus einem Douglas Adams Roman gerissen wiederfinden. Good News, denkt man, wenn man jemandem zutraut, den Platz des viel zu früh verstorbenen Per Anhalter durch die Galaxis-Autors einzunehmen, dann ist es wohl der ehemalige BBC-TV-Serienschreiber Gaiman. Anansi Boys fängt auch sehr vielversprechend an mit den von Fans so geliebten Adamschen Weltbeobachtungen und seltsamen Unmöglichkeiten aus Douglas Adams' Galaxie. Leider verliert sich Gaiman sehr schnell im allzu wilden Kopieren der Fantasieausbrüche des schriftstellerischen Vorbildes und scheitert daran, dass er einfach nicht ganz so funny ist wie Adams. Nach einigen Seiten gähnt man und nach einem Drittel legt man das Buch weg. Ich zumindest. Anansi Boys von Neil Gaiman, bedingt zu empfehlen für Douglas Adams-Fans.
Goldman's War von John Scalzi. Das Erstlingswerk von John Scalzi, der inzwischen auch Fortsetzungen der Geschichte veröffentlicht hat, steht in der Science-Fiction-Tradition von Robert E. Heinlein. Protagonist des Buches ist der 75-jährige John Perry, dessen von ihm sehr geliebte Frau schon Jahre tot ist und der sich vor dem Dahinsiechen in langer Krankheit fürchtet. Einziger und überraschend oft durch Anwärter auf die geriatrische Abteilung gewählter Ausweg ist die freiwillige Meldung zu den außerplanetarischen Truppen, da die Kolonien nur in den und überbevölkerten Staaten offen stehen. Und mit seinem 75. Geburtstag hat John Perry endlich das Mindestalter erreicht. Nach der Unterzeichnung von Geheimhaltungspapieren, niemand auf der Erde weiß, wie eine derartige Armee aussieht und funktionieren soll, reist er mit anderen Freiwilligen ins All. Neben einigen vorhersehbaren Ereignissen, Protagonisten erhalten neue Körper und den unvermeidlichen Computer eingepflanzt, die Truppen kämpfen mit Außerirdischen, hat John Scalzi genug Ideen, um auch die mit dem Metier vertrauten Leser ab und zu überraschen. Oldman's War von John Scalzi ist ein unterhaltsamer Page-Turner, der bisher nur im Englischen vorliegt.
Wer im Sommerurlaub so richtig abschalten will, der liest einen dicken, fetten Fantasy-Schinken. Hier The Sword of Truth von Terry Goodkind. Der erste Band überrascht mit einigen wirklichen Ungewöhnlichkeiten, dem dezenten Auftauchen von in Anführungsstrichen modernen Problemen wie Umweltschutz, Gleichberechtigung und Rassenproblemen zum Beispiel und einigen Kapiteln mit physischer und vor allem psychischer Folter, die in ihrer kinderungeeigneten psychologischen Tiefe sehr gut auch in einem Bret Easton Ellis, einem Thomas Harris oder einem James Ellroy auftauchen könnten. Spätestens beim dritten der bisher 11 800 Seiten Bände der Serie ist Sword of Truth dann aber doch auf dem Weg zur Fantasy-Einheitsware. Mit der zurzeit im amerikanischen TV laufenden Serie hat das Buch übrigens nur den Namen im Lizenzvertrag gemein. Die komplette Simple-Mind-Plattheit der TV-Show wäre eine Beleidigung für zwei Drittel aller modernen Fantasy-Bücher und für das moralische recht komplexe des Sword of Truth erst recht. Sword of Truth von Terry Goodkind, auch auf Deutsch als Schwert der Wahrheit erschienen, sehr zu empfehlen für den Genre-Freund. Thank you.
The Reaper von Josh Bissell. Von Herrn Falschgolds ausführliche und überschwängliche Rezension Josh Bissells von der New York Times als eines der besten neuen Bücher des letzten Jahres gefeierten Erstlingswerkes Beat the Reaper zum Lesen verleitet, verlebte ich mit der in die Tageslänge eines Assistenzarztes eines New Yorker Krankenhauses mit Rückblenden in seine kriminelle, gewalttätige Vergangenheit gequetschte Erzählung 4,5 äußerst unterhaltsame Stunden, in denen die Geschichte fast parallel als Film vor meinem geistigen Auge mitlief und absurde Einfälle und böse Witze einander jagten. Stoff für Quentin Tarantino oder von mir aus auch Guy Ritchie wird die Erzählung vielleicht auch bald in übersetzter Form vorliegen. Bis dahin bleibt die recht leicht zu lesende englische Ausgabe absolute Empfehlung der Redaktion von Studio B.
The Lincoln Lawyer von Michael Connelly, ein klassischer Anwaltskrimi irgendwo zwischen Boston Legal und Philip Marlowe, kam uns unter in einem Test des neuen E-Book-Readers Kindle im New Yorker, wo er als Beispiel herhielt, dass es bei allen Stärken und Schwächen der derzeitig am Markt belesbaren Geräte am Ende auf das Buch ankommt, was man liest. Und wenn das nur spannend genug ist, dann liest man es, wo man geht und steht. Genau diese Eigenschaft kann man dem Lincoln Lawyer bestätigen. Der Ich-Erzähler Michael Holler ist Strafverteidiger in Los Angeles und vertritt die Philosophie, dass noch der größte Verbrecher einen guten Verteidiger verdient, wenn er genug zahlt, und ist dabei doch nicht hart genug, sein immenses Geschick beim Ausnützen von Lücken im Strafgesetz nicht ab und an mal pro bono zu vergeben. Aber zumindest zu Anfang noch ist die Hauptsache das, wie er es geschickt demonstriert, Mr. Green im Zeugenstand auftaucht.
My job now was to take the case to trial and elicit testimony from the deputies and pilot as to the altitude they were flying when they went over the ranch. If they told the truth, I had them. If they lied, I had them. I don't relish the idea of embarrassing law enforcement officers in open court, but my hope was that they would lie. If a jury sees a cop lie in the witness stand, then the case might as well end right there. You don't have to appeal a non-guilty verdict. The state has no comebacks from a non-guilty verdict. Either way, I was confident I had a winner. We just had to get to trial, and there was only one thing holding us back. That was what I needed to talk to Casey about before the judge took the bench and called the case. My client sauntered over to the corner of the pen and didn't offer a hello. I didn't either. He knew what I wanted. We'd had this conversation before. "Harold, this is calendar call," I said. "This is when I tell the judge if we're ready to go to trial. I already know the state's ready, so today's about us." "So?" "So there's a problem. Last time we were here, you told me I'd be getting some money. But here we are, Harold, and no money." "Don't worry, I have your money." "That's why I am worried. You have my money. I don't have my money." "It's coming. I talked to my boys yesterday. It's coming." "You said that last time, too. I don't work for free, Harold. The expert I had go over the photos doesn't work for free, either. Your retainer is long gone. I want some more money, or you're going to have to get yourself a new lawyer. A public defender." "No PD, man. I want you." "Well, I got expenses, and I gotta eat. You know what my nut is each week just to pay for the Yellow Pages? Take a guess." Casey said nothing. "A grand. Averages out a grand a week just to keep my ad in there, and that's before I eat or pay the mortgage or the child support or put gas in the Lincoln. I'm not doing this on a promise, Harold. I work on green inspiration." Casey seemed unimpressed. "I check around," he said. "You can't just quit on me. Not now. The judge won't let you." A hush fell over the courtroom as the judge stepped out of the door to his chambers and took the two steps up to the bench. The bailiff called the courtroom to order. It was showtime. I just looked at Casey for a long moment and stepped away. He had an amateur jailhouse knowledge of the law and how it worked. He knew more than most, but he was still in for a surprise. I took a seat against the rail behind the defendant's table. The first case called was a bail reconsideration that was handled quickly. Then the clerk called the case of California versus Casey, and I stepped up to the table. "Michael Holler for the defense," I said. The prosecutor announced his presence as well. He was a young guy named Victor DeVries. He had no idea what was going to hit him when we got to trial. Judge Orton Powell made the usual inquiries about whether a last-minute disposition in the case was possible. Every judge had an overflowing calendar and an overriding mandate to clear cases through disposition. The last thing any judge wanted to hear was that there was no hope of agreement and that a trial was inevitable. But Powell took the bad news from DeVries and me in stride and asked if we were ready to schedule the trial for later in the week. DeVries said yes. I said no. "Your Honor," I said, "I would like to carry this over until next week, if possible." "What is the cause of your delay, Mr. Holler?" the judge asked impatiently. "The prosecution is ready, and I want to dispose of this case." "I want to dispose of it as well, Your Honor, but the defense is having trouble locating a witness who will be necessary in our case." "An indispensable witness, Your Honor. I think a one-week carryover should be sufficient. By next week, we should be ready to go forward." As expected, DeVries objected to the delay. "Your Honor, this is the first the state has heard about a missing witness. Mr. Holler has had almost 3 months to locate his witnesses. He's the one who wanted the speedy trial, and now he wants to wait. I think this is just a delay tactic because he's facing a case that..." "You can hold on to the rest of that for the jury, Mr. DeVries," the judge said. "Mr. Holler, you think 1 week will solve your problem?" "Yes, Your Honor." "Okay. We'll see you and Mr. Casey next Monday, and you will be ready to go. Is that understood?" "Yes, Your Honor. Thank you." The clerk called the next case, and I stepped away from the defense table. I watched a deputy lead my client out of the pen. Casey glanced back at me, a look on his face that seemed to be equal parts anger and confusion. I went over to Rinaldo Rodriguez and asked if I could be allowed back into the holding area to further confer with my client. It was a professional courtesy allowed to most of the regulars. Rodriguez got up, unlocked a door behind his desk, and ushered me through. I made sure to thank him by his correct name. Casey was in a holding cell with one other defendant, the man whose case had been called ahead of his, in the courtroom. The cell was large and had benches running along three sides. The bad thing about getting your case called early in the courtroom is that after the hearing, you have to sit in this cage until it fills up with enough people to run a full bus back to the county jail. Casey came right up to the bars to speak to me. "What witness were you talking about in there?" he demanded. "Mr. Green," I said. "Mr. Green is all we need for this case to go forward." Casey's face contorted in anger. I tried to cut him off at the pass. "Look, Harold, I know you want to move this along and get to the trial and then the appeal, but you've got to pay the freight along the way. I know from long, hard experience that it does me no good to chase people for money after the horse is out of the barn. You want to play now? Then you pay now." I nodded and was about to turn back to the door that led to freedom, but then I spoke to him again. "And don't think the judge in there didn't know what was going on," I said. "You got a young prosecutor who's wet behind the ears and doesn't have to worry about where his next paycheck's coming from. But Orton Powell spent a lot of years in the defense bar before he got to the bench. He knows about chasing indispensable witnesses like Mr. Green, and he probably won't look too kindly upon a defendant who doesn't pay his lawyer." I gave him the wink. "Harold, if I want off the case, I'll get off. But what I'd rather do is come in here next Monday and stand up out there and tell him we found our witness and we are ready to go. You understand?" Casey didn't say anything at first. He walked to the far side of the cell and sat down on the bench. He didn't look at me when he finally spoke. "As soon as I get to a phone," he said. "Sounds good, Harold. I'll tell one of the deputies you have to make a phone call. Make the call, then sit tight and I'll see you next week. We'll get this thing going." I headed back to the door, my steps quick. I hate being inside a jail. I'm not sure why. I guess it's because sometimes the line seems so thin. The line between being a criminal attorney and a criminal attorney. Sometimes I'm not sure which side of the bars I'm on. To me, it's always a dead-bang miracle that I get to walk out the way I walked in.
Doch ist dies nur der Beginn der Handlung, die hier nicht im Ansatz verraten wird, schon weil meine Kollegin Irmgard Lumpini noch nicht dazugekommen ist, das Werk zu verschlingen. The Lincoln Lawyer von Michael Connelly ist übrigens der erste Band aus einer geplanten Reihe mit dem Strafverteidiger Michael Haller als Haupthelden. Ich sage Spitze.